Chapter 26. White House Situation Room, Washington, D.C. President Porter nodded, and the lights were dimmed. The glowing presidential seal on the monitors was replaced by the black flag of ISIS. There was the sound of wind. Slowly, the flag began to ripple. Haunting music in Arabic poured from the overhead speakers. A picture of the Secretary of Defense faded up from the black. Public photos from the last 30 years of Richard Devon's life began to appear, each one materialized quicker than the last. As the pacing of the photos built to a crescendo, so too did the music. Then, everything went black. Everyone in the Situation Room braced for the worst. But like a terrifying horror movie, it was a feint, a move meant to keep its viewers off balance. Secretary Devon's voice now filled the room. The screens pulsed with digital snow, as if trying to capture some faraway signal. Then, the video came into focus. It was the secretary's swearing-in ceremony at the Pentagon. The words were his oath of office, administered by the vice president. But the swearing-in video was soon replaced by images of war and carnage. American tanks, troops, and planes were shown intercut with dead and dismembered Middle Eastern men, women, and children. All the while, Secretary Devon could be heard proudly and confidently reciting his oath. There was applause as the vice president congratulated Devon, and the screens in the Situation Room went black once again. Now, the worst would come. A fraction of a second later, the video roared back to life. The motorcade was under attack. The attackers shouted, "Allahu Akbar," as they stepped into the street, firing their fully automatic rifles. The attack was covered from multiple angles. Not only were the terrorists wearing GoPro cameras, but there was also footage of the carnage taken from up above. Cameras must have been placed in windows or on rooftops. It was slick and well-produced. It looked like something out of a Hollywood action movie. It was gut-wrenching to watch. No one in the Situation Room spoke. They were saddened and sickened by what they were watching play out on the screen. Everyone knew how it ended, but no one could turn away. They were all mesmerized, prisoners of the violence and barbarity unfolding in front of them. When the final moment came and the first car bombs exploded, the video transitioned into slow motion. If there was an Academy Award for evil, ISIS would have taken home an Oscar. It was as if the devil himself had gotten into the film business. The video ended with a masked figure standing in the desert, taunting the president. He spoke English like an American. He was different from the Brit and Aussie spokesmen the world had seen before. "Unite your coalition. Mobilize your armies. Exact your revenge," he said. "You know where to find us. We're waiting for you." And with that, the video shrank into a single point of light and disappeared, like an old television set being switched off. The lights in the Situation Room came back up. The members of the President's National Security Council sat stunned. No one spoke. They were all without words. Then, as if a starting gun had gone off, they all began speaking at once. Tempers were hot. President Porter called for quiet and directed CIA Director McGee to bring everyone up to speed on the latest. "The video you just saw was published by the media arm of ISIS less than 2 hours ago," the director said. "We're in the process of analyzing it now. In the meantime, I want to update you on the explosion last night in Antalya, Turkey." Activating his presentation, he put a slide up on the monitors that showed two pictures. One was the smoking, burned-out hulks of at least 15 vehicles. The other looked like a huge bomb crater. "The photo on the left," the director narrated, "is a crime scene photo from the car bomb attack on Secretary Devon's motorcade. The photo on the right is from an explosion about 6.5 kilometers away. That happened several hours later."
"We're assuming they're connected?" the vice president asked.
McGee nodded. The FBI had already sent forensics teams to Antalya to gather evidence from Secretary Devin's attack. When the second explosion happened, a small contingent of FBI technicians agreed to aid Turkish police in their investigation. The explosion leveled almost half a city block. It was an industrialized area, mostly warehouses. No word yet on casualties.
What's the connection?
The FBI's preliminary finding is that the explosive signatures match, McGee replied. We think ISIS was using one of the warehouses as a bomb factory. And judging by the size of that crater, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs stated, they still had a lot of ingredients left, which Turkish intelligence assumes was meant for further attacks inside Turkey. They see this as a major escalation. İsmet Bajcar, the chief of the Turkish General Staff, has even canceled his vacation and returned to the capital. Good, the National Security Advisor chimed in. If they'd actually been serious about ISIS from the get-go, maybe Secretary Devin would still be alive. Maybe. But McGee didn't want to get into hypotheticals. At this point, they're bending over backward to give us everything we need. What about the man in the video? The Secretary of State interjected. He sounds American. Do we have any idea who he is? Not yet. How about where they got their intelligence? The Attorney General asked. Have we identified a specific leak yet? No, not yet. What about the three Turks that Secretary Devin's team plowed down during the attack? Have we learned anything more about them? Anything that might be helpful? McGee shook his head and repeated, No, nothing yet. Has the NSA had any luck isolating what part of the cloud the attackers uploaded their GoPro footage to? The CIA director shook his head. It was demoralizing for everyone present. A silence fell back over the room. The Secretary of State decided to take advantage of the lull. Mr. President, if I may ask, are you still planning to renounce recognition of the Sykes-Picot boundaries? Porter had been expecting the question. I am, he replied. Have you decided when? No. Why? This is going to unleash unprecedented chaos, the Secretary of State said. It'll make the Arab Spring look like a fifth-grade field trip. Israel is our ally. They deserve more than just a heads up. They need time to get ready, to dig in. And if we... Porter motioned for him to stop. I told you that I would worry about Israel, and I will. I know they're our ally. I also know this is going to be difficult for them. But we're going to make sure they have the biggest stick in the sandbox. I don't understand. You will, he said. In the meantime, I believe the chairman of the Joint Chiefs has something for us. Are you ready? We are, Mr. President, he responded. Porter nodded. Anticipating that ISIS was responsible for the attack on Secretary of Defense Devin and in retaliation for the attack on the CIA's SAD team in Anbar, the president asked the Pentagon to draw up a response plan. Nodding to an aide, the chairman had a target map uploaded to the monitors as he continued. Codenamed Iron Fury, the attack focuses on the following: known ISIS command and control centers, training facilities, and, most importantly, oil infrastructure. The Secretary of State studied the map and then asked, And it will launch when? The chairman looked at the president, who again nodded. Right now, the chairman replied. The three-hour attack, codenamed Operation Iron Fury, began with two waves of B-2 Spirit stealth bombers, each carrying a payload of 80 500-pound Mark 82 bombs. As they destroyed a series of critical oil refineries, volleys of Tomahawk missiles were fired from a U.S.-guided missile destroyer in the North Arabian Gulf and a Los Angeles-class attack submarine in the Red Sea. As those found their targets across Syria and western Iraq, Reaper drones armed with Hellfire missiles and accompanied by F-22 Raptor fighter aircraft took out hundreds of tanker trucks at multiple points along the Syrian border as they prepared to smuggle oil into Turkey and Iraq. Not since the last Gulf War had anyone in the Situation Room seen such a massive air assault. When it was over, and all the pilots were out of Syrian airspace, they sat in silence for several minutes. Then, President Porter told his chief of staff to have the press secretary ready a statement, and then he declared the meeting over. As the attendees gathered up their papers and filed out, Porter pointed at the CIA director and asked him to hang back a moment. Once they had the room to themselves, he gestured for McGee to take the chair next to him, and they sat back down. "Now," said the president, "I want to hear for real. Where are you on the leak?" "Same list of names," McGee replied. "It hasn't changed." "Yet." The CIA director nodded. "I know it feels like nothing is happening, but we've got a lot of wheels in motion. Believe me." "I know. I just have a very bad feeling." "About the leak?" "About all of it," said the president. "I don't think we've seen the worst of it yet. Not by a long shot." Chapter 27. Guadalupe, Mexico. The room wasn't much, but it didn't need to be. Sasha Basayev was only passing through. There was bottled water in the fridge, along with a few beers. Not enough, though, to get drunk and do something stupid. Probably a smart move on the owner's part. His wasn't the kind of business you wanted to draw attention to. Dinner had been dropped off by a heavy-set Mexican in a white cowboy hat. He didn't speak. The food came from the restaurant down the street. It tasted like baby goat. Basayev ate a few bites, then set it aside. He didn't have much of an appetite. A doctor came by and gave him a physical. The old man reeked of tequila. He listened to his heart and lungs, took his blood pressure, and had him blow into a spirometer. He had him walk from one end of the room to the other, do a set of deep knee bends, some push-ups. He then asked a series of questions in very bad English. Basayev lied in response. The doctor wrote everything down in a small blue notebook. When he was done, the doc patted Basayev on the shoulder and made the sign of the cross over him. He had passed. A couple of hours later, the Mexican in the cowboy hat came back and motioned for Basayev to follow him. He had a truck outside. They climbed in. The man drove him to an old machinist shop. They entered from the back and only turned on a couple of lights. It was after hours, and they were the only ones there. In the main work area, a collection of scuba equipment had been laid out on a stained table. Nearby was an old television set and an even older VCR. The man in the cowboy hat pointed to a folding chair. Basayev took a seat. The man turned on the TV, inserted a VHS tape into the dusty machine, and pushed play. The screen sputtered to life with a scuba demonstration video that looked like it had been filmed in the 1980s. Basayev attempted to explain that he didn't need to watch the video, but the man in the hat was quite insistent. Apparently, his organization had standards. The video ran for 45 useless minutes. When it was complete, the man in the hat had Basayev assemble the scuba equipment and put it all on. He pantomimed for Basayev to demonstrate his familiarity with the gear, that he understood how to purge his mask and clear his ears. Basayev did as instructed. He then removed a tailor's tape and measured him, entering the numbers into a text message on his cell phone and sending them off. And with that, they were done. The man in the cowboy hat took Basayev back to his room and dropped him off, all without uttering a single word. That was fine with Basayev. He wasn't paying for conversation. In fact, the less anyone spoke to him, the better. The man in the hat had pointed at his watch, indicating what time he would be back, and then motioned for Basayev to get some sleep. Sleep sounded like a good idea. He was going to need his strength for what lay ahead. Removing his clothes, he stretched out on the bed. He had cracked the window to get some air in the room. Now, from off in the distance, he could hear the low rumble of thunder. There had been a chance of storms in the forecast, but he had hoped they would slow before they arrived over this part of Mexico. There had already been too much rain. If the next storm was big enough, it might shut things down altogether. His mind raced as he lay there on the bed, something he didn't usually let it do. He could feel the walls closing in on him, the air being squeezed from his body. Claustrophobia. The more he tried to get his thoughts under control, the more they raced. Getting up, he retrieved one of the pills he had brought and snapped it in half, just enough to help him sleep. Opening up a bottle of water, he swallowed it and lay back down. Still, the same problem. He had never spoken of his claustrophobia. It wasn't anyone's business. Professionally, it had never been a problem. Personally, it was another thick white ribbon of scar tissue that he carried from that horrific day in Beslan. He knew it was all in his mind, that it was a toxic byproduct of being crammed into the gymnasium in the heat with all of those people, then the fire, then the stampede, losing his sister Dasha, his best friend Grigori. It was his psyche, what little he understood of it, looking for a way out, a way to protect itself, to protect him from the trauma. He had learned to deal with it like everything else. Things were what they were. He could either adapt and overcome, or wither and die. He was too angry to die. There was far too much that still needed doing. His veins needed to flow with ice water. He had survived, while his family, friends, and teachers had died. He had a responsibility, an obligation to persevere. The sedative eventually took hold and quieted his mind enough for him to fall asleep, but only fitfully. When the knock came upon his door, he felt worse than if he hadn't gotten any sleep at all. The man in the cowboy hat brought him tamales with a large cup of coffee and indicated that he'd be back at the bottom of the hour. Basayev knew it was important to eat. Setting the coffee aside, he focused on the food. After finishing half of the meal, he wiped down the room and the tiny attached bathroom. Whether anyone would ever know he had been here or not, he didn't like to leave a trail. He finished his food just as the man returned. Grabbing his coffee, a bottle of water, and the few possessions he had on his person, he followed him downstairs and out to his truck. It was dark, but Basayev could see that the ground was soaked. In the few hours he'd been asleep, it had rained a lot. Despite the chilly air, he began to perspire. The drive took more than 3 hours. They headed north toward Laredo and the Mexican border with Texas. Their destination was a region called Llanos Esteparios Noreste. The area was home to Lake Venustiano Carranza, the Salado and Sabinas Hidalgo rivers, as well as the Camarón and Jalameses creeks. It was also home to the only known entrance of an extensive natural cave system that burrowed beneath the Rio Grande and stretched just across the border into the United States. It was accessed via a man-made tunnel on a privately held ranch. Driving up to a service gate, the man in the hat hopped out, removed the chain, and drove his truck through. After he locked the gate behind him, they continued on. It took 20 minutes on a dirt road that seemed to stretch forever before they saw what they were looking for. The clustered ranch outbuildings were made from cinder blocks and corrugated metal. The man in the hat parked in front of the widest one, but only long enough to activate the large overhead door and drive inside. An old Jeep CJ7 was already parked there. Basayev's guide was in the process of unloading all of the equipment. The greatest risk Basayev faced, besides decompression sickness or drowning, was getting lost in the cave system. Hence the guide. Most of the system was flooded. Because of the narrow passages they would have to navigate, they would be carrying their diving cylinders side-mount style, along their hips, as opposed to on their backs. And the cylinders would be smaller than what open-water scuba divers normally used. They would have to be judicious with how much breathing gas they consumed. That had been one of Basayev's biggest concerns. If there had been too much rain and the dry portions of the cave system had filled up with water, They wouldn't have enough breathing gas to make the trip. Once all of the gear was stacked on a flatbed cart, the man in the hat removed a set of keys and opened a door on the other side of the garage-like space. The man-made tunnel hairpinned back and forth and was lined with bare bulbs covered with wire baskets. It was a no-frills venture, the money having been spent on excavating the tunnel and navigating the cave system. The ranch, and thereby the cave system, belonged to Los Zetas, commandos who had deserted the Mexican army to become enforcers for the Gulf Cartel. Eventually, they established their own criminal syndicate. The United States government considered them to be the most technologically advanced, sophisticated, and dangerous cartel operating in Mexico. When the previous owner of the ranch had stumbled upon the caves, he figured Los Zetas would jump at the chance to use them to run drugs. But being underwater, with so many tight passages, made it ineffective for moving drugs. That didn't mean, though, that Los Zetas didn't have other ideas. They were smart enough to realize that certain people would pay big money for a sure-thing entry into the United States, especially people who considered being smuggled overland by a coyote too fraught with risk. Basayev was one of those people. He could have used his Lufthansa alias, but he didn't want any record of his having entered the United States. Not with what he had planned. It was too risky. In order to not leave a trail, he had to do it this way. He had no choice. At the bottom of the tunnel was a ramp that dropped into a pool of crystal clear water and disappeared beneath the far wall of the cave. Basayev could feel his heart rate beginning to increase. The guide, who couldn't have been more than 18 or 19 years old, tossed him a dry suit and told him to get dressed. Basayev popped one of his pills and washed it down with the rest of his water. As he got ready, his guide unrolled a waterproof map and walked him through the route they were going to take. They confirmed hand signals and went through a host of final checklist items, including the triple checking of their gear. With everything ready, the guide spoke a few words to the man in the hat, turned on his primary light, and stepped forward into the water. Basayev followed as the man in the hat took the flatbed cart and returned back up the tunnel. Taking several deep breaths to saturate his lungs, he put the regulator in his mouth and dropped below the surface. The moment he did, the claustrophobia began to wrap its ice-cold arms around his chest and squeeze. He told himself to focus on what lay ahead, on the United States, and what he would achieve. As he scissored his legs through the water, his heart began to pump, his body began to warm, and the sedative moved through his bloodstream. Slowly, his panic started to recede. As it did, his mind cleared, and he began to contemplate how to handle his guide once they were safely on the other side. Chapter 28. Berchtesgaden, Germany.
"Get out," Alexandra Ivanova said as Harvath stepped into her room. "Now."
He ignored the request, as well as the gun she had pointed at him.
"You and I need to talk first."
"We don't have anything to talk about."
Harvath closed the door behind him.
"We have lots to talk about, starting with what you're doing here."
"What I'm doing here? What are you doing here?"
"House hunting."
"Get out,"
Alexander repeated, cocking the hammer of her checkmade CZ pistol.
"Before you ruined my assignment."
"Care to tell me what it is?"
"Let me think," she said.
Then, after an extremely brief pause, she replied,
"No."
He had forgotten how good English could sound when spoken by a Russian woman, especially one so attractive. Alexandra had always been a striking woman, but she was even better looking than he remembered. She was tall, with long blonde hair, and a very fit body.
"Maybe we can help each other," he said.
"I doubt that."
"Come on, Alex.
Do you have any idea how long it has taken me to get this close to Malevsky?"
she asked.
"What I've had to put up with? The risks I've taken?
Risks? What are you talking about? Malevsky is one of yours.
Alexandra glared at him.
Are you sure you have the right Malevsky?
Are you?
Mikhail Malevsky, Mafia, from Moscow.
Correct, said Harvath.
And how do you know you have the right person?
Because I've debriefed two assets on his payroll.
Russians?
Harvath shook his head.
Germans. One works at Lufthansa, the other in operations at Frankfurt Airport.
I knew it, she said. I knew he had to have people on the inside.
Well, he does. Now, will you put the gun down, please?
Alexandra lowered her pistol.
So, he's using Frankfurt Airport and not Munich.
Harvath nodded.
You guys are worse than we are. Don't your agencies talk to each other?
What are you talking about?
The SVR and the GRU. Don't you communicate with each other?
Alexandra looked worried.
What does the GRU have to do with Malevsky?
Jesus, Harvath said to himself. They really don't talk to each other.
Malevsky works for them.
Doing what?
I don't have the full picture. That's why I'm here.
So paint a partial one for me,
Alexandra replied. Harvath was reluctant to give up too much too soon. He and Alex might have had a history together, but they played for completely different teams. The GRU has an operative we've taken interest in.
That's it?
She asked when he didn't elaborate. Pretending to search for her weapon, she said,
Where did I put my gun?
Harvath knew her better than that. She knew exactly where her weapon was.
You heard about the U.S. Secretary of Defense?
She nodded.
I did. I'm sorry.
We think the GRU operative we're looking for had something to do with it.
Alexandra was taken aback.
You think the GRU was behind the assassination of your Secretary of Defense? That's insane.
Maybe. But Russia had plotted worse, much worse in the past, and Harvath and Alexandra had untangled it together. He shot her a look that said all that and more.
For argument's sake, she replied, let's say you're correct. What's your interest in Malevsky?
He's the middleman, said Harvath. He's the link between the operative and the GRU.
Which you put together via your sources at Lufthansa and the Frankfurt Airport.
In part, he replied. Now, you tell me something I don't know. What the hell are you doing here?
Alexandra drew a deep breath and let it out, slowly.
ISIS.
Harvath waited a beat, but when she didn't continue, he said,
Keep going.
She lowered her head. Shame? Embarrassment? He wasn't sure, but right now he didn't care. He wanted answers.
The largest contingent of non-Arab ISIS fighters is made up of Russian speakers. Chechnya, Dagestan. I could keep going, but you get the point.
Harvath certainly did get the point. Foreign jihadists, Chechens in particular, had flooded into Iraq during the war like a pustulant, festering sore that had been popped with a red-hot needle. The Chechens had brain-dumped into the Iraqi resistance all the devious and deadly techniques they had developed fighting the Russians. It had been a huge game-changer, and the American death toll had soared. People Harvath knew and cared about had been killed. He hated the fucking Chechens. They had cycled their fighters through Iraq, they had gotten real battlefield experience, and then they had returned to Russia to kill.
It's Iraq all over again, said Harvath. You're worried they'll come back and cause trouble at home.
Alexandra nodded.
It would be very bad for Russia.
Bad for Russia? Or the Russian government?
When innocent Russians get killed, it's bad for Russia. That's what I care about. The Russian government can kiss its own ass.
After all this time, she hadn't changed. She was still the same woman. The government had screwed her father, also an intelligence operative, and she still hadn't forgiven them. She cared about her people and her country. Her government could go to hell, or, as she had said, kiss its own ass. Hopefully, Harvath could still trust her.
I'm waiting for you to tell me something I don't know. Why are you here? What drew you to Malevsky?
She took a moment to compose her thoughts and then said,
"He's part of their finance mechanism."
"Malevsky?"
Alexandra nodded.
"He helps them get things they need. Medicine, night vision goggles, parts for their aircraft."
"What's in it for him?"
"A bottomless well of priceless antiquities."
Harvath felt a knot form in the center of his chest.
"What do you mean?"
She shook her head.
"Seriously? The Moscow Syndicate has been moving billions in priceless artifacts for ISIS. They move it out of Syria and Iraq up into Europe and Russia."
It was like someone had punched a hole right through the center of him.
"Smugglers."
"Some of the best."
"What else do they move?" he asked.
Alexandra smiled.
"Weapons. Lots and lots of weapons. And not just low-end items like rifles and RPGs. They also move serious high-tech product. Ground-to-air missiles. Air-to-air missiles. They are a high-speed operation."
The knot in Harvath's chest was spreading.
"How did they move it?"
She reflected for a moment and said,
"Most of the artifacts come through Turkey, hidden in ISIS oil tankers."
"No. The weapons. How'd they move the weapons?"
Alexandra laughed.
"They were actually very clever. They allegedly had a Muslim doctor on their payroll. He was able to exploit countless medical relief missions and convoys. The Red Crescent, the United Nations, you name it."
Harvath, who had never had a weak stomach in his life, suddenly felt like he wanted to throw up. Chapter 29. It was all happening way too fast. What she was asking was way too dangerous, and it was off the charts stupid. They needed to take a breath, step back and take a breath, take a minute and assess, but they didn't have a minute.
"I'm only giving you one shot," Alexandra said. "So, make it count."
Harvath drew back his hand and struck her, hard. She bounced off the nightstand and the bed frame as she fell down. Her nose bled profusely. He reached down and pulled her panties away with a snap. Tucking them in his pocket, he then ripped off her bra and dropped it next to her. She'd had her own idea of how she wanted her lipstick to smear, and he'd already given in. It was the least he could do. Rubbing it off his mouth and onto his sleeve, he exited her room and headed down the back stairs. Outside, he found the bald man's corpse right where he had left it. He transferred Alexandra's panties to one of the man's pockets. After getting a sit rep that showed everything was clear, he then ran like hell. Out of breath and near the edge of the property, he reached back to the United States.
"Round Top, this is Norseman."
"Go ahead, Norseman."
"Coming out."
"Roger that, Norseman. On your command."
"Do it now."
"Roger that, Norseman," the command center replied as they scrambled the satellite signal from the ground sensors. "You are good to go." As he scrambled up the boulders, the sharp pieces of rock slashed at him, but he kept his footing and kept moving forward. Bursting from the trees at the top of the ridge, he took Hermann by surprise.
"Let's go," he ordered. "Let's fucking go."
"Are you okay?"
Hermann said.
"What happened?"
Harvath collapsed in the passenger seat and managed to shut the door.
"Drive,"
he said.
"But just drive,"
Harvath snapped. Hermann did what he was told. Minding the speed limits, stopping where indicated, and not giving local law enforcement any reason to pull them over, Hermann returned them to the farm. He pulled in next to Harvath's car behind the barn and said,
"You want to tell me what happened?"
"No."
That was all he said. Climbing out of the car, he shut the door with a reasonable amount of force and headed toward the farmhouse. Hermann sat there for several minutes, wondering what he should do. Finally, he turned off the engine and followed him inside. He found Harvath sitting near the fireplace, a glass in his hand, with two fingers of bourbon over ice.
"Ready to talk?"
Harvath didn't respond. The giant shook his head, walked back to the kitchen, and got himself a drink. Returning to the living room, he took an adjacent chair and sat down. He didn't care if Harvath didn't want to talk. They could play the silent game for hours. His friend shouldn't be alone. Harvath came to the end of his bourbon and started to rise. Hermann waved for him to remain seated. The German returned moments later with the bottle and a bucket of ice. Harvath refilled his glass. Apparently, they would not be putting a bag over Mikhail Malevsky's head tonight, and so Hermann had poured himself another drink too. They continued until the bottle was empty. Hermann tossed it into the fire. It shattered and the flames leapt.
Music?
Hermann asked, buzzed. Harvath didn't reply. He sat and stared at the fire. Hermann found his iPhone and pulled up a random playlist. Seconds later, Don McLean's American Pie began. Harvath's eyes closed, and Hermann was worried he had done something wrong.
Why'd you pick this? Harvath asked.
I don't know, his friend said. I like it. It's a good song.
Harvath's eyes remained closed.
Do you know what it's about?
Hermann shrugged.
The day the music died. The death of Buddy Holly.
It was actually a warning.
A warning? About what?
About the future, and what was coming if America didn't wake up.
Hermann looked at his friend.
What the hell happened tonight?
Harvath didn't respond. He seemed content to listen to the music. Hermann decided to leave him alone. Throwing another log on the fire, Hermann sat back and sipped his drink. When Harvath wanted to talk, he'd talk. Half an hour had passed when Harvath began counting something on his fingers.
What are you doing? Hermann asked.
Counting.
I can see that, the German replied. What are you counting?
How many people I got killed.
Over your career, or just recently?
Just recently,
Harvath answered. It was deadpan, without any emotion.
What's the number?
13, he said, and still going up.
And still going up?
Hermann repeated.
Does that mean you're still in the fight?
Harvath nodded. His friend leaned forward.
What the hell happened tonight?
For a moment, Harvath looked like he had no idea how to answer the question. His mind was somewhere else, drifting.
I got played, he finally explained.
Played? What are you talking about?
I blew the number one rule in the intelligence game. Don't get played.
Hermann looked at him.
I still don't know what you're talking about.
I had what I thought was an incredible asset,
Harvath replied, shaking his head.
A doctor from North Africa. He was moonlighting as a smuggler. His name was Salah Abaoud. He produced some incredible intel for us. Turns out, he worked for Malevsky.
And thereby, said Hermann, the GRU.
Harvath nodded.
The CIA team we staged an Anbar to nail a high-value ISIS target? That was based on intel developed through Salah.
Why would the Russians want the CIA team wiped out?
It's not just the CIA team. Salah is dead. His mistress is dead. The Secretary of Defense and his entire protective detail are dead.
Hermann still couldn't figure it out.
But why?
Harvath shook his head.
I don't know. All I know is that it's my fault.
Why is it your fault?
Because I didn't see it. I'm trained to see it, and I didn't.
Hermann offered to refill his glass, and Harvath brushed him away.
The Russians can be clever,
Hermann offered.
Very clever. Don't let them get in your head.
Get in my head? The Russians are on a fucking killing streak, and it's my fault. How do you not let that get in your head?
Said Harvath. Hermann threw up his hands and leaned back in his chair.
Take your time. Be angry. When you're ready to get even, let me know.
Harvath stared into the fireplace and watched the hot blue flames lick at the thick, dry logs. Orange embers smoldered in the gray ash beneath. He drank his bourbon and thought of the men and women who had died, and as he thought about them, his anger grew. He hated the Chechens, but he hated the Russians even more. No matter how many times they had pounded them into the ground, they kept popping back up. They were as serious a threat as the jihadists, but now they appeared to be using the jihadists, using them as a proxy to do their extremely dirty work for them. Drinking his last swallow of bourbon, Harvath felt it burn as it rolled down his throat. He then turned to Hermann and said, "I can see only one way to handle this."
"I'm listening," the German said.
"There's just a problem, though."
"What's that?"
"Your wife won't like it," Harvath replied. "We're going to do something illegal again. Very illegal."
Chapter 30. Washington, D.C. Liliana Grace was an attractive woman in her late 30s. Chestnut hair, perfect teeth, and just the right amount of makeup. She had made it in her business by being twice as smart and twice as hungry as any of the other reporters at the Washington Post. She didn't like sneaking around, but from time to time it was a necessary part of the job. Senator Wells had chosen the location, a seedy bar in southeast D.C.
"You're positive?" Wells asked. 100%.
As he talked, he jabbed the tiny squares of ice in his cocktail with a bright green plastic straw. They were seated in a small stained booth with duct tape over the rips in the seats. The table between them was covered with cigarette burns. The lights were low, and the place smelled like spilled beer and urinal disinfectant.
"You take a lot of meetings here, Senator?" Grace asked, waving her own straw around the dimly lit bar.
"Only the important ones. Now, keep your voice down and answer my question."
"I told you, I came up with nobody."
"Not one single person?"
"That's usually the definition of nobody," she replied, as she took a sip of her gin and tonic.
"Fuck."
"It doesn't mean the information you were given isn't true. It just means none of my contacts know anything."
Wells had not survived in D.C. as long as he had without being very careful. He wanted to believe Rebecca was right, that what she had picked up at her CIA boyfriend's apartment was right, but it was so damn risky. If the president and the CIA had known about the threat to Secretary of Defense Devin in Turkey and had done nothing about it, it was a huge story. He couldn't break it, though. Hell, he couldn't even hint at it, unless he was sure it was true. Grace was the chief intelligence correspondent for the Washington Post. Before that, she had been assigned to the Pentagon. She had the best damn sources in town. If she couldn't substantiate Rebecca's claim, it wasn't worth taking public.
"I believe you have something for me?" she asked,
as Wells fell silent and played with his ice.
"Excuse me?"
"We had a deal. I look into your rumor, and in exchange, you give me the background on what happened in Anbar."
"Right," said Wells, refocusing on their conversation. "Anbar." Grace removed a pen and notepad. She knew there was no way the senator was going to let her record this. "It was a CIA operation. They were hunting high-level ISIS members," Wells began. "A lot of mistakes were made." The conversation didn't last terribly long. Senator Wells still didn't have much information. The only new piece of information he had was on Ashley Foster, the CIA officer from the U.S. Embassy in Jordan. McGee had sent over a memo explaining that Foster had been dating one of the men on the CIA SAD team. She had convinced the other two women from the embassy to travel with her to Anbar. From start to finish, it had been an exercise in extremely poor judgment.
"That's it?"
Grace exclaimed, once Wells fell silent and went back to stirring his ice. The senator nodded.
"How about the names of the specific ISIS members the CIA was looking for? It sounds like they dispatched a pretty high-level team. They also sent two very covert helicopters. They must have had some idea who they were going after."
"No clue," said Wells.
who raised his empty glass and signaled the bartender to bring him another. The CIA director wouldn't tell me.
You mean he wouldn't tell the committee?
No, I mean me, personally. My committee was never briefed, nor was the House committee.
Grace leaned forward.
Excuse me?
Director McGee only came to me after the attack in Anbar.
That doesn't make any sense. Even if the president decides covert action is necessary, he has to issue a signed presidential finding authorizing it. And that finding has to be presented to both committees ASAP, before any activity begins.
It didn't happen.
Grace thought for a moment.
If memory serves, the president can delay reporting, but only in extraordinary circumstances. He can also limit who the report goes to. At a bare minimum, it would have had to go to the House and Senate leaders of each party, as well as the chair and ranking member of each intel committee. Were they briefed?
Wells nodded. But only vaguely, and not until after, with no explanation for the delay.
Interesting, the reporter replied,
as the bartender set down the senator's drink.
No, I'm good, thank you,
she said when he gestured at her glass.
She was hard for Wells to read. There was blood in the water. She should have been able to smell it. She was a media shark.
So? The senator asked.
Like I said, it's interesting.
Interesting enough to do an article?
Grace set her pen down.
You're running for president.
I have made no such determination.
She smiled at him.
A story like this could be damaging to your opponent.
It could also generate some excellent revenue for your organization and be good for your career, Wells countered.
Maybe.
Maybe? What the hell was she talking about? He was offering her a scoop. He hated how inscrutable she was. He didn't like it when he couldn't read people.
Perhaps I made a mistake coming to you, he said.
You made a mistake, but it wasn't in coming to me, she replied. Your mistake was in thinking I'd take what you told me and run with it.
He leaned forward and smiled.
Have I ever steered you wrong in the past?
No, he hadn't. But this was different.
He was gearing up for a possible run at the presidency. Anything he offered that was damaging to the current administration had to be viewed through that lens. She shook her head.
You've always provided me with solid information.
And I'm doing so again.
What is it specifically that you think the White House is up to? Why are they playing coy with Congress?
Off the record? The senator asked.
Off the record, she agreed.
Wells leaned in even further.
I think President Porter, in conjunction with the CIA director, is running his own extremely black ops program and intentionally keeping it from Congress.
Picking up her pen, the reporter signaled the bartender that she was going to need another drink after all. It was going to be a long night.
Chapter 31. Berchtesgaden, Germany. The bald man Harvath had killed at the estate was a guest of Malevsky's named Valery Kumarin. He was a drunk and a womanizer. He was also a very influential figure in organized crime. He and Malevsky were in the same syndicate but different branches, which were often at odds, particularly when it came to territories. Kumarin had flown in from Moscow to discuss taking some of the ISIS business. The fact that he had died while visiting Malevsky was going to cause problems. Big ones. Worried about a hit, Malevsky might very well go to ground. If he did, he wouldn't be taking his wife and children with him. He'd find someplace else for them. That someplace else would include Alexandra. If there was any way to prevent it, she had to try. When Harvath had explained what had happened outside, she was ready to kill him. In a matter of hours, he had ruined more than 2 years of work by the SVR. She had to come up with a plan, quickly. With Kumarin dead, there was only so much she could do. The key was in helping reinforce the narrative that it was an accident. All of Malevsky's men had seen Kumarin eyeballing Alexandra. Even Malevsky's wife had noticed.
The Russian mobster wasn't exactly subtle. Alexandra decided to use that to her advantage. He was drunk. He forced his way into her room. He struck her in the face and tried to have his way with her. She fought back, kneeing him in the groin to get him off of her. Groaning, he had retreated from her room. That was the story she told after Malevsky's men had beaten down her door and found her curled up sobbing on the floor of her bathroom. While everyone agreed the situation wasn't good, it was beyond obvious what had happened. Kumaran was a pig. Trying to force himself on Alexandra was beyond the pale. He had taken the easy way out by falling down the stairs outside and breaking his neck. If he hadn't, Malevsky would have killed him with his bare hands. That left them with one final item to deal with, the body. If they called the police, they would be inviting all sorts of problems. If they didn't, they'd be inviting an entirely different set of problems. Malevsky was damned regardless. The only way out was to shift the responsibility to someone above him. Back in Moscow, the powers that be were not happy. He had taken all the appropriate precautions with making contact, but this was a dead body on his property in another country. They might have been criminals, but they hadn't gotten to where they were by being stupid. Malevsky was putting them in a very difficult position. His superiors turned it right back around on him. What if, they suggested, it wasn't an accident and someone is trying to frame you? That didn't do much to ease Malevsky's anxiety. If he hid the body, he could be in trouble. If he didn't hide the body and he went to the authorities, he might still end up being in trouble, especially if someone was trying to frame him. They told him to stay by the phone. They would call him back. Malevsky looked for some vodka, but couldn't find any. They were out.
Fucking Kumaran.
Finally, the phone rang. A decision had been made. Get rid of the body. And as soon as that was done, they wanted Malevsky to return to Moscow so they could question him in person. That could mean several different things, many of them not good. Not good at all.
Fucking Kumaran.
Malevsky saw to the disposal of the body. Then he packed a bag. Ever since he had hung up the phone, he had been thinking about running. He had enough money hidden in different banks in different countries. He could live quite well. But if he ran, it would be an admission of guilt. He wasn't guilty. He hadn't done anything. If he were going to kill Kumaran, he certainly wouldn't have been stupid enough to do it on his own property. He also wouldn't have been stupid enough not to have an airtight alibi. He would go to Moscow, state his case, and return home. He wasn't going to run. He had half a mind to take the nanny with him, to let her explain what had happened, but he decided against it. It would make him appear weak. His word should be enough. If they required any more corroboration than that, two of his security team would be with him. He'd bring one of the men who had found the nanny on the bathroom floor, and one of the men who had found Kumaran at the bottom of the stairs. It had been an unfortunate accident, but it was an accident nonetheless. If anything, fucking Kumaran had brought it upon himself by getting so blind drunk. There wasn't a one of them back in Moscow that didn't know how bad his drinking was. Malevsky doubted this was the first time the old fool had fallen. In fact, he'd probably tripped and fallen too many times to count. If they were honest with themselves, many of them back in Moscow would have to admit that it was a wonder Kumaran had survived this long. The problem with Moscow was that they were rarely honest with themselves. Exiting the house, travel bag in hand, Mikhail Malevsky found his men in the motor court, milling around the Rolls Royce.
"Let's go," he barked in Russian.
The 5'7" barrel-chested mafioso had been a wrestler in his youth. Now in his mid-40s, his thinning blonde hair was going gray. He was plagued with psoriasis, and he had to pop tons of Viagra just to get an erection. Those factors, combined with his already distasteful personality, made him perpetually angry, abusive, and predisposed to acts of extreme violence.
Even the four-letter word descriptions used by his enemies didn't come close to doing him justice. Adding to his foul mood was the fact that it had taken forever to arrange a jet to fly him back to Russia. He hated flying commercial, but he hadn't been able to justify the cost of owning his own plane. So he had split the difference and bought into a private jet program. As was typical of criminal syndicates, he knew a guy who knew a guy, and that was whose advice he took. The company Malevsky had bought into was fine for trips planned weeks in advance, but if you needed to fly right away, they were a disaster. He nearly had an aneurysm yelling into the phone at the client service representative trying to find him a plane. Eventually, the company found him a Gulfstream G650, and they not only agreed to waive the upgrade fee for such an exclusive aircraft, but also to have it pick him up in Salzburg, rather than his having to drive the further distance to Munich.
Respect, Malevsky had thought as he hung up the phone. Some people expect it, others demand it.
He was going to look like a rock star traveling in that aircraft, not only to the men who were traveling with him, but also to anyone meeting him at the airport in Moscow. And he was going to make sure there were people waiting to meet him in Moscow. Only a fool would blow an opportunity to make that kind of an entrance. Rolling out of the wrought iron gates of the estate, they made a right turn and headed down into the village. Privately, Malevsky had been pleased that the old hunting lodge hadn't sold yet. His wife and two children enjoyed it here. It was a simpler pace, cleaner and less hectic than Munich. There were also no Muslims. He didn't mind doing business with them in their part of the world, but he certainly didn't want to raise his family around them. They were animals, unclean, uncivilized. At least in Russia, they knew how to deal with them. Russia recognized all too well the threat that they posed. Malevsky sank back into the quilted leather seat and tried not to think about Muslims, Kumarin, or having to deal with his superiors back in Moscow. He was in one of the most beautiful places in the world, being driven in a Rolls Royce, on his way to board a $65 million aircraft. He had come a long way in life, and he still had much further to go. If he had time, there was a girl he wanted to see in Moscow, a dancer. She was the complete opposite of his wife. She didn't complain. She liked to have fun, and she had a tight ass.
Oh, that ass.
He would have to make the time to see her. Malevsky closed his eyes for a moment in order to picture her. As he did, he felt the car slow.
Chort was me,
the driver said. Damn it.
What is it? Polizia.
Police. They were being pulled over. The words,
Chort was me,
passed through Malevsky's mind, but what came out of his mouth was something completely different.
Fucking Kumarin,
he said, as he reached for his diplomatic passport. Chapter 32. There were two parts of Harvath's plan that he regretted. If he had been able to find a better way, he would have taken it, but time was against him. Alexandra's texts had been sporadic. Everyone at the estate appeared to believe her story. Kumarin had been drinking and had tried to rape her. They had found his body outside at the bottom of the stone steps. Whether he had hit his head or had broken his neck, it didn't matter. He was dead. They had decided not to call the police and had gotten rid of the body themselves. Malevsky's bosses had called him back to Russia for a full accounting of what had happened. There was concern over an internecine conflict in the organization. Malevsky was not well liked. Kumarin's people were likely going to want revenge. The crime family was trying to stop things before they could get started. Had it been anyone other than Alexandra on the inside, Harvath wouldn't be getting this kind of intel. Even though her assignment was potentially in turmoil, she kept gathering information and feeding it out to him. What he had told her about Malevsky, the GRU, and the operative named Sasha Basayev was very serious. Too often, Russia's military ambitions extended far beyond what was best for the rest of the country. Alexandra was willing to help Harvath, but only to a point. It needed to be a two-way street. As long as he continued to cooperate, So would she. With Alexandra having committed to the story of Kumaran attacking her, Harvath couldn't return to the estate and snatch Malevsky. They would immediately suspect she had played a hand in both situations. It was too dangerous. Hermann hadn't seen another option. Harvath, though, had. He didn't have a problem with lightning hitting the same bad guy twice, just not in the same place. They would have to get Malevsky outside his estate. Alexandra had confirmed that Malevsky's security detail were former Russian special forces. Harvath had been right not to underestimate them. These were not guys he wanted to go head-to-head with unless he absolutely had to. It would be better to outmaneuver than to outgun them, which brought Harvath to the two most regrettable parts of his plan. The first involved Anna Strobel. If she had said no, he would have understood. He knew, though, that there was a part of her that wanted to right the wrongs her husband had committed, even if that meant putting herself in further jeopardy. Within 20 minutes of receiving Harvath's call, she was on the road. The next element was the wild card. It was the riskiest step in his plan, and the one he disliked most. Unlike Anna, the participants in this phase weren't being given a choice. They found a Bavarian state police vehicle 20 minutes outside Berchtesgaden. Two young officers were clearing a dead deer from the road. Harvath took their duty belts and radios at gunpoint. Then he marched them into the forest and had them handcuff themselves around a large tree. He left them with a couple of bottles of water and returned to the road. Hermann had already departed with their vehicle. Removing his balaclava, Harvath hopped in his car, dropped a pin in the GPS app on his phone, and followed. He wanted to make sure that they sent the authorities to the right location. Back at the barn, Anna inspected the vehicle.
I probably shouldn't ask where this came from.
Probably a good idea, Harvath replied.
I'd also keep your gloves on, said Hermann.
You're aware that the Landespolizei use a tracking system for all their patrol cars, correct?
Harvath held up a pair of wire cutters.
Not this patrol car.
Where's Eichel?
In my trunk, Hermann replied. We don't go anywhere without him.
Is he still alive?
Anna said.
Or is that also something I shouldn't ask?
He's still alive, Harvath stated.
What are you going to do with him?
That depends on what happens with Malevsky.
So, in other words, you don't have a plan at this point?
Harvath smiled, then nodded at Anna and Hermann.
Everything is going to depend on you two.
Taking over, Hermann led them through the next steps. Harvath felt his phone vibrate and removed it from his pocket. It was a text from Alexandra. He read it and then said,
Malevsky is getting ready to move. Let's get going.
Anna got behind the wheel of the state police car. She was wearing her Bundespolizei uniform, but the name tape had been removed. Hermann climbed into the passenger seat next to her. Harvath exited the barn and slid inside Hermann's BMW. There was really only one route to Salzburg Airport, and while Malevsky's team might conduct a surveillance detection route to make sure they weren't being followed, Harvath wasn't afraid of losing them. He was more concerned with where they were going to spring their trap. They had to do it before the border with Austria, and Harvath wanted it in an area with no witnesses. And on top of those two parameters, the state police would soon be out looking for their two missing officers and their patrol vehicle. The sooner they could get this over with, the better. They picked up Malevsky's Rolls-Royce halfway through Berchtesgaden and followed it out of the village. There was a stretch of farmland that the road passed through before it came to the next village. That was where they were going to take them. Harvath had hung back so as not to arouse suspicion. He was also acting as a screen, blocking any potential view of the police vehicle. A few kilometers out from the takedown location, Harvath slowed and Anna passed him. She was now in the lead. She trailed the Rolls-Royce for a bit before beginning to close the distance. Then, once she was ready, she activated the light bar on the roof of her vehicle and pulled them over. Harvath had hung way back and now pulled over to the side of the road as well.
He could see the flashing lights ahead, but that was it. They had decided that it wasn't worth running the risk that one of the men with Malevsky might have been on duty when Harvath toured the estate. If he was recognized, that would ruin everything. They wanted this to go as smoothly as possible. Hermann had promised to keep his microphone open. Harvath would have to be content to listen as everything went down. Harvath knew enough cops to know that in police work, there was never such a thing as a routine traffic stop, and what they were doing right now was highly dangerous. The unknown was whether or not Malevsky's men were armed. His diplomatic passport all but guaranteed that the transition across the border would be a non-event. They had to assume there were guns in the car. Not only that, they had to assume the guns would be close at hand, and Malevsky's men would be ready to use them if they had to. But Malevsky's men were professionals. They were smart enough to know that the officer would call in their license plate before getting out of the patrol vehicle. They were also headed toward Salzburg and the border. If they got in a shootout and killed a police officer, they were going to have a hell of a time getting across. They would play it cool, at least until it was time not to play it cool. Harvath was sure about that. They would figure out why the cop had pulled them over and then make their decision on what to do.
"We're making our approach," said Hermann over the radio.
The plan was for Anna to move up along the driver's side and for Hermann to move up on the passenger side. Harvath could hear wind and the rustling of clothing over his earpiece as Hermann moved forward. Moments later, Anna identified herself as Bundespolizei. Hermann, who was in plain clothes, was identified as a member of Kripo, short for Kriminalpolizei, the detective branch of the Landespolizei. There were plenty of joint task force operations in Germany. It would also explain, if necessary, why a uniformed federal police officer was in a state police vehicle. The Rolls-Royce's driver asked why they had been pulled over. Anna replied by requesting everyone's documents. Malevsky immediately produced his diplomatic passport and started trying to take control of the situation. There was something else Harvath knew from having friends who were cops. The first test in any encounter with law enforcement was the attitude test. If you failed that test, things only got worse for you. As Anna collected their documents, she continued to question the driver. Where were they coming from? Where were they going? How long had they been in Germany? What was their business? Who owned the vehicle? What were they transporting? Malevsky grew impatient and began to tell Anna off. She was solid as a rock, though. With her game face on, she locked eyes with him and told him to get out of the car. When he refused to, she pulled open his door, put her right hand on her pistol, and asked him again. One of Malevsky's men made a move Hermann didn't like. Sweeping his coat back, he drew his own weapon halfway out of its holster.
"Everyone," he said, "get your hands where I can see them. Do it now."
"Out of the car," Anna repeated to Malevsky.
"Do you know who I am?" he demanded. "Who my family is?"
Anna drew her weapon.
"Now,"
she commanded. Her authoritative tone left no doubt as to who was in charge.
"I will own you after this. Do you understand me, girl?"
he said as he complied and exited the vehicle.
"Place your hands on the rear of the vehicle and spread your legs." "This is an outrage. I am a diplomat. You have no right to do this." "According to the laws of Germany, I have every right to do this. Now, place your hands on the rear of the vehicle and spread your legs."
Malevsky began speaking rapid-fire Russian into the car. One of the men inside lowered his hands. Hermann pulled his weapon fully from the holster and pointed it into the Rolls-Royce.
"I shoot the next person who moves. Are we clear?"
Everyone in the vehicle froze. Harvath's voice crackled over Hermann's earpiece.
"There's a car coming. You need to wrap this up."
Hermann looked at Anna and said,
"I think we should continue this discussion at headquarters."
"Headquarters?" Malevsky protested. "I have a flight to catch."
"You can catch the next one," Anna replied, as she snapped a set of handcuffs on him. "Your men are free to follow us in their vehicle. We'll settle all of this there."
Malevsky was pissed off, yelling to his men in Russian as Anna led him back to the police car. Hermann waited until she had gotten him in the back seat. Then he backed toward her, his eyes glued on the men inside the rolls. Getting into the seat next to her, he shut his door and looked behind them. Harvath was already gone.
Make a U-turn and start heading back.
Are you sure?
She asked. Hermann nodded.
They'll never make it.